Today, we are talking about being a woman working in a predominantly male profession and imposter syndrome. Whew, buckle up. This is a stark conversation. Hey, friends, and welcome to Stark Conversations. Here, we will have some bare bones and avoidable but necessary discussions. I'm your host, Heather Stark. Friends, for years, I kept my tongue glued to the roof of my mouth so that I could fit society's idea of a pretty, pleasing woman. However, I always felt broken. It wasn't until I was in my 40s that I realized I'm not broken. No one is broken. It's the way the world was built and the oppressive expectations from society that makes us feel broken. At that moment, I realized how important having a voice in space was, how vital feminism, that's right, feminism is to our world. Feminism is the path to advocacy, healing, and equality. Each week, I'm going to bring you a conversation on the importance of feminism, an action-oriented way of life that empowers, raises voices, and welcomes all people. Please like and subscribe anywhere podcasts are played. I would love to be in conversation with you. Alani Bankhead is a keynote speaker, consultant, and professional coach. She spent the last 20 years hunting spies, terrorists, and child sex traffickers. She was even the senior bodyguard to a top Pentagon official. Alani's new mission is to help individuals and teams overcome their self-doubt and fears to thrive at work and life. She is such an enthusiastic humanitarian. It is going to be so fun to listen to this conversation. Friends, I give you Alani. Oh my goodness. Well, and I just hit record, so you know. Your support, because doing stuff like that is super vulnerable, you know? Yeah. Right. And I knew there was going to be backlash. You can't not have backlash, mm-hmm. right? And that was just, you know, like that much. But there were so many sweet stories, and, you know, yours was just, which we'll talk about in a second, when you were like, Jesus was 10,000% woke. How do we not know this?
100%.
I was like, oh, she gets it. Yeah. So I was so happy to be able to reach out and to connect. And then, of course, your story, I'm finding my discussion points. I'm so sorry. Your story is amazing, what you do. And I'm like, how can I not talk to her and get to know her?
Well, it's so fun to get to meet another badass lady boss. I love your business concept. Like, we need more of this. So it's so fun to see your website and see all the amazing products and work that you guys are doing. So yes, don't quit. Keep going. We need you to expand.
We are. I mean, we check ourselves. We need to do more honoring diversity and things like that. And so we've made a commitment to do that and advocate and create space for women that need that. I understand my point of privilege and I need to keep that in check. So
you are highly gracious and kind and building, like, you just go a little bit at a time, right? You can't be all the things all at once. And your company's message and branding is just so loving. Like, it will all work itself out. So I'm really excited for you guys.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. But let's talk about you.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So tell me, number one, my first question I ask all my guests is, what does feminism mean to you?
Feminism to me is really simple. I think it's just believing in equality for men and women. So mm-hmm. you're not saying that any one gender is better than any other. It's just everybody deserves equal opportunity.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. Greatness. Okay. So keeping that in mind, you do work in a predominantly male career field.
I do.
So tell me what that is like as a woman I will read your bio at the beginning of this podcast, but let's just go over kind of all of the things that you've done
tell me about being a woman in that. And then let's talk about how you got there.
Yeah. So being a woman in a predominantly male career field, and it's like multiple areas, right? So I am military, I am law enforcement, I've worked with special operations. So sometimes I joke, it's like I'm in the trifecta of type A assholes, for lack of a better term. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to even say that on this podcast.
You are.
But with that being said, there are also a lot of really amazing men that I have had the privilege to work with. And many of them are still dear friends and mentors of mine to this day. But I think to your point, the challenges of being a female in that kind of space, you know, initially I thought it was a big crutch for me. I remember being in Iraq in my CHU when I was working for special ops, like ugly snot bubble crying because I was like, why am I a girl? Like, I feel like this big, muscly, like special operator deep down. But when I look in the mirror, all I see is weakness, honestly. Mm-hmm. And that was a big theme for me for a long time of just sometimes I look at pictures of myself. So I have this one picture from when I went to bodyguard training and my team, I was the only girl and somebody on our team had printed the pictures out and I was so short compared to everybody else. And I was like, I'm not that short. I'm like eye level with you guys. and they're like, no, honey, you know, but, so yeah, it always felt like a weakness for me, but then over time I just had the opportunity to see that actually that was a big advantage for me being a female. So all these things that I thought were weaknesses actually from a mission standpoint ended up being really, really big tools for me to get the job done. So as a perfect example, when I was with special operations, I was a human intelligence operator, which meant, you know, like in the movies when people are meeting with informants in secret and have briefcases full of money and you're getting intelligence for information. Like I used to do all that stuff. And my boss one day of, you know, our human unit was like, oh, Alani got some information that we didn't think we could get access to because if I put an abaya on, I looked like I blended in with the Iraqis. And I, you know, I wasn't, for lack of a better term, like Caucasian, like looking very different from the rest of the population. For those who can't see me, I'm Hispanic, so I have slightly tan skin, and I could stay quiet and they wouldn't hear my accent. And so I was able to blend in and get access to this intelligence that nobody else could. And that was when things started opening up for me as far as my aperture and my awareness that, oh, actually, no, this diversity element gives me an advantage in a lot of ways. And so after that, it was kind of game over. So yeah.
Wow. Okay. So have you ever heard of the woman Kate Warren from history?
She sounds super familiar. Was she a CIA chick?
She was the first woman detective. Yes. And she's my favorite woman that we have in my business. And so everything that you're saying, I'm like, oh, Kate Warren.
Yes. Oh, so I love great. It. I can't imagine how tough it was for her.
Oh, my goodness. No, her, and she has a fascinating story. When we first debuted her back in 2016, you know, there was like an inch worth of stuff. And we've recently kind of updated all of our stuff. And I got to write more about her. And it's really fascinating, the cases that she cracked and her famous line that won her the job with Alan Pinkerton was, you know, as a woman, I can worm out the secrets. I'm going to fit in. And she loved disguises and stuff. So I'm eating this up, what you're saying. So tell us all of the things that you have done in this career field.
Oh, man. Okay. In a nutshell, so I came into the Air Force because I wanted to do counter drug work. So I lived in South America at the height of Pablo Escobar drug stuff and saw the effect of the drug trade on this beautiful culture. And it really bothered me. So I thought I wanted to do intelligence work to fight the drug trade. Fast forward, the universe was conspiring in my favor. It wasn't actually drugs that I wanted to work. It was protecting the vulnerable. So for me, my life purpose has been all about protecting and uplifting life, especially the most vulnerable. And so that led me to an accidental career of being a federal agent. I thought I wanted to be an intelligence analyst or an intelligence officer, and I kept getting blocked, like roadblock after roadblock and all these no's. And then the universe was like, how about being a special agent? And I really thought it was something completely different. I thought it was like an internal affairs thing. And so I reluctantly said yes, thankfully, to recognize that it was nothing like what I thought it was. And so I started my career in northern Japan working drugs and counterintelligence. And then that's when I got my my first taste of the child protection mission. So arresting people who want to sexually abuse children. That's when I got hooked into that. And then I deployed to Iraq, where I did my human intelligence operations work with special ops for a while. And then after that, I went to our headquarters at Quantico, where I was in charge of our worldwide technology protection investigations and operations. So all that means is we have really cool classified tools like the F-22, right? Really cool fighter jets and missiles and rockets and satellites and stuff. And our adversaries, whether they're terrorists or spies, want access to those. They want to see what we can do either to defeat them or create their own. So my job was to manage all the 220 units worldwide that were running those cases and operations to make sure that we maintain our Air Force supremacy. And then from there, what did I do next? Oh, I was the commander of our counterterrorism unit, counterintelligence, counterterrorism unit in Kuwait. So in Kuwait, and this was at the height of the Arab Spring, if there was a terrorist event, that's my fault. So needless to say, I didn't really sleep very much. Yeah, it was stressful. Oh, shit. And then from there, I was selected to be the personal security advisor to one of the top Pentagon officials, which is a fancy way of saying I was a senior bodyguard. And then from there, I left active duty. I pursued my passion to protect the vulnerable. And so I was in charge of child sex trafficking cases and investigations and operations and training foreign police in South America for one of the largest anti-slavery nonprofits in the country. And then from there, I went to Hawaii. I was the alternate commander for our Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. So setting up all of the To Catch a Predator operations that you see on TV, where people are pretending to be kids online, human trafficking, training police, all that stuff. So I did that for a while. And then now I consult and coach primarily on imposter syndrome, helping world changers overcome their internal barriers so that they can do their life work. And then I also still consult on the law enforcement side. So, man, that was a lot.
It was a lot. It's very impressive too. So you said that being a woman actually kind of helped you in these fields.
Yes.
Can you give me more examples of that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So case in point, bodyguarding, I think, was the ultimate. I mean, my imposter syndrome was so loud when I got that job. My bosses first approached me, and this wasn't a typical job in the military where you were assigned the job. You had to be invited to apply. And I actually thought I was just the fluff package for whoever they wanted to actually get the job. And then, long story short, I got selected, and I was like, I can't do this. I'm a girl. Like, and I'm 5'3" and I look really young for my age. And does somebody have the wrong file? I literally asked my boss that. I was like, you must have the wrong file in front of you because I'm not bodyguarding material. And when I first went to training, so there's an advanced training you have to go to. It's our first day. We're doing introductions. I'm the only female in the class. And I realized that I'm the most senior bodyguard and that my protectee is the most senior of all the protectees represented in the office, which meant that I technically was like the most senior security advisor in the room. And I was like, oh my gosh, like I don't belong here. So thankfully, on a break, I had a moment of vulnerability and word vomited my fear all over this instructor. And he looked at me with his big pot belly. He was like smoking a cigarette. And he's like, listen, like, I know you think that you're not the right fit because of your femaleness and your appearance and all these things. But he said, this work is all about how you use your brain to control the physical space to protect your person. So the majority of the work that we do in bodyguarding work happens before the event. So you're getting lists of people who were going to attend. You're vetting them to make sure they're not a threat. If they are, they're removed before you even get there. You're doing site surveys. Like, there's all this work that goes into it. And 2 years later, when I was leaving the job, that same instructor called me and said, we noticed a thing with your team where you guys were basically the only team out of all the teams that didn't have any security incidences. And we actually think it's because of your appearance. So because nobody believed that you were the bodyguard because you don't look like it, you were kind of undercover, whereas other teams with like really tall, muscly, bulky guys, you know, people would see them and realize, oh, that's the bodyguard, and, you know, kind of bow up to them. And in bodyguarding, you don't know why a threat is presenting. You just know that a threat is present and your job is to separate your protectee from that threat. You figure out the why later. But the point is that he was like, you had an advantage, we think, because you're a female and you're petite and you look very young. And so you operated covertly. And so that's just one example. And for me, solidified that, oh, me being a female actually is one of the biggest strengths that I have. I just didn't realize it. So
that is so interesting. I love that so much. And I love this idea of just this, your femaleness is kind of a nonviolent, you know, way of being, because that makes me think of Sacagawea, who we also represent. And she was there for Lewis and Clark as a sign of peace. And, you know, we come in peace. We don't need to have this aggression. So that's really fascinating.
100%. Yeah. And so that's the core message that I like to share, is the thing you think is your weakness is actually the key to unlocking your superpower. So one example I like to give when I do public talks is dyslexia. So there was this research done on Fortune 500 CEOs, and they found that a very high proportion of them have dyslexia. And when they peeled back the onion layers, what they discovered was that because as a child, they had to learn a new unique way to read, that these very same folks that struggled to learn how to read as children are now saying that resiliency and the ability to create solutions outside the box is what gave me the edge in business. And so it doesn't matter what you think your weakness is, you know, as a girl, whether it's presenting, you know, I'm non-threatening, I'm non-violent, my brain is my greatest asset, you know, I am highly intelligent, I can come up with solutions. It's just a matter of reframing that weakness, and then like magic happens.
I love that. Let's talk a little bit about the human trafficking, because it's a scary thing to talk about. And I know that people think it, you know, it's happening over there away. Mm-hmm. And it's not. It's happening in our backyards. I was a school counselor, and towards the end of my time, it was like, okay, it's time to start talking about this. And even at that time, so this was 2014, 2015, it was just very global. There wasn't a lot of depth to that training. But tell me about that. Tell me about protecting the vulnerable.
Definitely. Yeah. Thank you so much for caring and for bringing awareness. It is a really hard topic to talk about. And I have found that, you know, I work drugs, counterintelligence, lots of different missions. This is the one that a lot of people just prefer to bury their heads in the sand because it's so difficult. And so I'm very compassionate towards those who aren't ready. And so if anybody's turned off, it's okay. It's totally okay. It is absolutely to your point in every community. And that's something people don't want to acknowledge, again, because it's scary. I was just having a conversation with this phenomenal female data analyst. She's brilliant. And one of my frustrations from the anti-trafficking side is law enforcement often leads with bravado and makes decisions without the data. And so, you know, her whole thing is like, we need data to make decisions. And I'm like, yes. And she's doing her, you know, she's a female, very strong female, standing on her truth of it might be boring, but the data is important. And so One reason why communities don't like to talk about it is because they don't have the data and it's scary. So people are making a lot of kind of assumptions about what might actually be happening. But the truth is that there's a lot of misconceptions around trafficking. So they think it has to be transnational, right? You're kidnapped, like put into a van. But the truth is that the majority of trafficking, it happens by people that we know, whether it's like a family member or a neighbor or, you know, some other person in our lives. So the majority of survivors are victimized by people in positions of trust around them, unfortunately. Things are really shifting with technology as well, to where it's no longer like the stranger danger type of crime, but oftentimes victims are groomed through phones. So our traffickers know exactly what they're looking for in the people they want to abuse. And so oftentimes it's people who come from like, you know, maybe a tough background, like maybe they're struggling with having trust and feeling love with their, you know, parents or guardians or whatever it might be. And so they find this love, quote unquote, from this person who's just trying to gain their trust. And unfortunately, a lot of survivors these days will literally just walk out their front door and willingly, quote unquote, go. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the movies present a certain picture of what trafficking's like, but it's actually very different. And so it happens at all demographics. It doesn't matter race, gender. Boys are trafficked a lot of times. We don't really talk about that very much. Socioeconomic groups as well are not affected. There was this amazing woman who gave a keynote not that long ago. She was upper middle class and trafficked by her husband and didn't even know at first. I mean, it's not limited to just poverty type groups. So yeah.
Yeah. How do you deal with all of this? Because you've got a job that's got, I don't want to use too strong of a word, but I want to be accurate. There's some trauma that can happen that, you know, how do you process that?
Oh, that's such a good question. And I'm going to be very honest with you that initially I didn't handle it very well. When you're in a job of service, so teaching or medical or justice system, you love the people that you're called to serve and you will give and give and give. And then unfortunately you get depleted and burned out and all of those things. And to be honest, my favorite coping tool was alcohol. And so, you know, at the end of the day, after dealing with a hard case, it would be, I'm going to have a glass of wine. And then it became two glasses of wine. And over time it became unhealthy for me. And so I don't drink anymore. But I had to learn the hard way that I had to self-care better. So, you know, all the things we talk about with diet and exercise and sleep that I used to roll my eyes at. I'm like, I know that sleep and exercise and diet are important, but I never applied those things, you know, early on in my career to my detriment, and my mental health really, really suffered. And so that's part of what I do now. And some of my work is when I consult, I build in the self-care stuff because we need people to stay in the field as long as possible. And unfortunately, you know, people love protecting the vulnerable so much. Like the people I work with are the most amazing humans and I am really honored to get to work with them. But you know, we all self-sacrifice, unfortunately, a little too much. I hope I'm a cautionary tale for a listener out there that, you know, you can love your work and it can also kind of eat you alive, and to really take care of yourself and be honest with yourself about what's healthy and what isn't healthy. So,
yeah, that's so good. You can love your work, but it can eat you alive. Yeah. You know, we don't always stop to think about it. We're like, but I'm doing what I love.
Exactly.
Yeah, you can't do it when you're
being
alive.
Exactly. And if I could just add one more thing too, I think especially as a woman, you are taught to serve and be helpful. And, you know, I hate to oversimplify, but I almost had a message of like, I'm not worthy unless I'm achieving and doing and all of those things. And I know that that greatly contributed because my male counterparts were way better at setting boundaries than I was. And so I had to really let go of those beliefs that like, I only matter if I'm doing things for other people. I had to realize that I matter because I exist. I'm a human being and
amen.
All of those things. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so good. And that's something that, you know, I think I would like to hope for like the next generation that it's getting better. But I mean, women are raised, you know, give. You know, you're the nurturers, give, and it comes at the expense. Can you give us some statistics about trafficking in terms of how many children are trafficked? You know, I don't know if what's most impactful, if it's a year, if it's a month, how are they enslaved? You know, those like real life terms that somebody that's listening, that's like, okay, but I live in a small town. It doesn't happen here. That would make them sit up and go, okay, wait, I need to keep my eyes open.
Oh man, that is a really good question because unfortunately we don't know the full extent of trafficking because it's such a covert kind of crime. I mean, I will say I've had the privilege of working in many jurisdictions. So I've worked on every continent except for Antarctica. and I haven't done trafficking cases in Africa either, but every jurisdiction I've had, I walked in and all I heard was, there's no trafficking here. There's no trafficking here. And then when we started looking into the actual cases, that's when the truth started coming out. So for example, in Hawaii, I facilitated the arrest with other people. Obviously, I didn't do this by myself, but there were close to 100 arrests. And of those 100 or so, 2 were tourists. And all we heard from the beginning was, oh, it's all these, you know, I have to oversimplify, but the white man's coming to rape and pillage all of our native kids. And then when the data presented itself through the work that we were doing, we had to go back to the groups and say, actually, this is a homegrown issue. This isn't limited to, you know, a particular belief or something you see out of the movies. And that can be really, really hard. And so that's data that I have hard numbers for. And it's the same thing that I've seen in every other jurisdiction where the enemy is always an outsider that comes in, but it's actually our own problem. And unfortunately, so the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children says that 1 in 4 girls is going to experience sexual abuse. So that's exploitation or trafficking. And then it's 1 in 7 to 10 boys, depending on which study you look at, are affected by those crime sets. And that's a lot of survivors. And unfortunately, that means there's a lot of perpetrators as well. And so society as a whole, you know, it's hard to take responsibility and accountability for, you know, our own behaviors. And that's why you don't really hear a lot about it or see a ton being done, because oftentimes the people in positions of powers are the ones that are perpetrating, unfortunately. And so it's just a really tough thing. But with that being said, I don't want you guys to be depressed. I am really hopeful in this space because there are some seriously amazing humans that are working the mission sets. So whether at the law enforcement, prosecution, victim services, aftercare side of things, advocacy, we are making headway to address the issue. And I think post-pandemic, the really important stuff is coming out as a whole of, you know, society was operating at a level that was unhealthy. And so, you know, the anti-trafficking child exploitation conversation is a part of that, of we have to address our shame and our guilt and our trauma, because otherwise these crimes continue to happen. And so until you have the courage to speak truth or shine a light on those dark parts of your soul that you're too scared to, you know, kind of look at because you're worried you're going to be judged, that's how these horrible things keep happening, whether it's you being the victim or you being the perpetrator. So yeah, it's complicated, but if we can work on ourselves and do the important work of being authentic, just like the work that you do, like that's just so important in elevating and inspiring others to just be their real selves, right? That's when we create that change in the justice space. So
I love that. And I've never heard that explanation, but oh my God, it's such common sense. But you're right. It is. It's very hard to do that. I actually remember being in, you know, obviously, like I think I was sitting on my bed during the pandemic. And I remember looking up shadow work because I just felt like really like I was just having all these, I was having to confront myself about a lot of things. And I'm like, what is this? And shadow work. And yeah, yeah, you're right. You're right. And I will say that I started finding my voice. It started saying, you know, yeah, confidence, right? Yes. Yeah. And if you don't start living authentic, once again, it's going to eat yourself alive, which we're going to talk about here in a second, because what I want to do, and this is going to start us down the path of eating yourself alive, because you mentioned it. And so I want to talk about it now throughout all of this. All of these careers, these big professional things that you've done, you've talked about imposter syndrome. So number one, let's talk about what imposter syndrome is. And I want to know how it affected you and in your work with people as a coach, what are the patterns that you see in terms of imposter syndrome?
Yes. So the term itself was originally imposter phenomenon, and it was coined in the 70s by these two amazing female psychotherapists. I'm probably going to mispronounce their names, but Dr. Immes and Dr. Clance. And the concept is that you feel that you are not qualified for your title, any accolades, positive feedback, awards, promotions, and that eventually your coworkers are going to figure out that you're not worthy of these things. And when you are found out, that horrible things are going to happen. So you might lose your job or the award or the promotions, and then your livelihood goes down the tube. And what the initial study found was that 70% of this all-female group that was studied, because initially they thought it was just a female thing, 70% of women experienced this phenomenon, and over 60 studies have been done since then, and the same numbers have come out. So it's about 70% of the population experiences this phenomenon during their lifetime, which is crazy.
Wow. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why? I mean, why does this pop up? Because it's so true. It is.
Yes. Yes.
Word for word.
So this is my theory. So to me, and this is a lot of what I teach now, is when you experience your imposter syndrome, even though it's scary, we want to fight it. And so some of the behaviors and symptoms of imposter syndrome are that you will overwork to overcompensate for the inadequacies that you think you have, which leads you to burnout. So burnout's, you know, a big one that you might have imposter syndrome. And, you know, things like, especially with women, inability to ask for a raise or ask for appropriate compensation during salary negotiations and stuff like that. These are all common with imposter syndrome. And I think that happens because whatever you're doing is so aligned with your true life purpose that if you fail at it, you're internally going to think, well, if I failed at my life purpose, then what good am I? And so your imposter syndrome is a mechanism that you created to keep you safe. So it tells you, it's usually an I am statement. So for me, it was, I am too small. I'm 5'3". I'm too female. I'm too Latina. And I look too young for my age. And the underlying statement with all those was, because I am these things, I am weak. Mm-hmm. So I can't project power. And so now I laugh when my imposter syndrome comes up because I realize that that means I'm doing exactly the work I need to do, the world-changing work to help encourage and uplift people. And that historically, I know when I experience the imposter syndrome, when I engage in certain spiritual practices, and everybody's a little bit different on what that looks like, that there's a miracle right around the corner. But I have to lean into that and learn how to harness that imposter syndrome and reframe that weakness so that the real miracle can happen. And so, yeah, it's very counterintuitive because your imposter syndrome is all about hiding yourself. But until you put those quote unquote weaknesses center stage, you're going to stay stuck. So I hope that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense because mine is, I am not pretty enough. I am not tall enough. I am not, I'm 5'7". I am not smart enough. I am not working hard enough. They're always, I am not statements. So Oh my goodness. And I like the fact that you point out that when it pops up, that means you are doing the thing.
Yes.
You're doing the thing.
Yes.
It reminds me of, I think it was Steve Carell, which of all the people to quote, I love him so much, but of all the people to quote, he was like, if you're doing that, being a little bit scared means that you are challenging yourself and you're rising to the occasion. So step into it.
100% And that sweet spot that he's talking about, I love talking about it with my clients because we know we get there when they're like, oh my gosh, this could be so exciting. But oh my gosh, I'm also like kind of terrified at the same time. That's when we know we're at the right growth space where you should be a little bit scared because you are growing into something new. But I love Steve Carell too. He's hilarious.
Yes, he is. Love him. Okay. So I'm going to use this imposter syndrome as a segue to how you and I came in contact because, I mean, I've said before, I'm not enough. I feel like I've had to hide myself. You know, my tongue has stayed glued on the roof of my mouth until I was in, probably around 38, 39, but then in my 40s, I was like, oh, I just glue it to the roof of my mouth. I don't say who I am. I don't say what I stand for. And I have this business and we, during the pandemic, were embraced by the homeschool community. And I was like, they've just brought us in. I love it. We sustained ourselves through the pandemic. And then we started touring with two separate companies. We very quickly realized that we had different values. You know, there may have been a love of Jesus, but we had two different ideas of what and who he was. And we just did not talk about, there's a train. I don't know if you can hear it.
Barely.
It's barely. Ruining.
It is all good. Keep going.
It's ruining my speech. And so people would say things and I wouldn't say anything. And then it started eating me up and I started getting sick before shows. And my sweet business partner, I finally said something to him and, you know, we had meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to loosen my tongue. And so I wrote this article, HuffPost. It went viral. You reached out and, you know, there was probably over 200 messages, but yours, yeah, it was crazy. Yours was the only one that was like, Jesus was a feminist. He was. How do you not get that?
100%.
And I was like, oh my God. Yeah. Yeah. So I want to talk about that. Tell me your thoughts about Jesus being woke and feminist.
Absolutely. Yes. And I completely agree with you. I see all of that division in the church and it just breaks my heart. And obviously the last 4 years have been so crazy in human history, right? Like all this upheaval and there's all this crazy stuff happening in the church right now. And you're right. There's a lot of differences in values. And I've spent a lot of time with my tribe talking through our perceptions of that and all of that. And I love how you would said, you know, it started eating me up, keeping my mouth closed. And, you know, it's funny because your imposter syndrome told you, don't say what you stand for. Don't open your mouth. And then as soon as you did, you had this incredible response from the public. And so that's a perfect example of you leaned into it and it was scary. And now look at all this stuff that's coming out of it. But as far as Jesus goes, you know, I 100% believe that everyone is entitled to their own personal beliefs and their spiritual walk is theirs. And everybody has different values. And part of why the world works well, as well as it does, or maybe, you know, it could be working a little bit better if we operated aligned with our values. Because when you don't, you get sick, right? But when it comes to my personal beliefs about Jesus, I 100% believe Jesus was a feminist because look at all the different roles that women played in his life and the different interactions, right? So presenting himself to the woman at the well, or even after his resurrection, who was the first person who came and found him? It was a woman. And it was a woman who was entrusted to go tell the whole world that he'd been risen from the dead and all of this stuff. And I think, you know, it's very easy to view Christianity in patriarchal terms because there are so many male characters, but there's so many powerful women in the Bible as well. And even in the lineage of Jesus, it's Rahab, right? The prostitute is part of that lineage. But there were only two women mentioned in that lineage biblically, but like there's a reason for that because they're important as well. And I truly believe that, you know, Jesus is love. Like, whether you believe in conservative or liberal values, it doesn't even matter to me. I always say, you know, the first commandment is love God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And the second one is love your neighbor as yourself. That's all Jesus did, was love people. It didn't matter what you look like. It didn't matter if you were Jew or Gentile. Like, he loved everybody the same. And so I think that's where I struggle a little bit when people feel like, you know, Jesus wasn't a feminist, because I'm like, he didn't distinguish between male and female. He just said, you have to love everybody. Everybody's of equal value. And so, man, this is a topic we could do like 10 podcast episodes on, but in a nutshell, like, that's what I believe. So,
yeah. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. I love that. So the idea that people reject it, do you push back on that, or like, how do you handle that?
I do. Okay. So for me, when I'm trying to have a conversation, I try to really distill things. And so the criteria for me is this a fruit of the spirit or is this a fruit of the flesh? So the Bible is very clear about the fruits of the spirit are love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, all those things. The fruit of the flesh are enmity, strife, like idolatry, like all those not so great things. And you can feel the difference in your body, right? Peace and joy feel very amazing and you want more of it versus strife and conflict. Like, you don't want that. And so when I'm talking to someone who is like, Jesus is not a feminist, and this is why, I ask them, in your body, are you feeling love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, or are you feeling conflict, strife, anger, all of those things? And usually if they answer me, it's no, I'm pretty angry about it, you know? And I'm like, that's, well, based on our, you know, text of our religious practice, that's not a fruit of the spirit. And so maybe you need to go talk to God about what's going on internally, right? It's not a good or bad thing to me. It's just an opportunity to learn. And that's how I've lived my life, is when I feel jealousy and envy and strife and all that stuff, that's a chance for me to go inside and see what's happening. Like, what do I need to work on to get back to peace and joy and all of those things? So that's the delineator for me.
Yeah. I love that. That circles back to just that shadow work a little bit that we talked about, you know, that's huge.
Absolutely.
Oh my goodness. Alani, this has been an amazing conversation. It's so joyful and uplifting. Tell people where they can find you.
Yes. So you can find me at mightysparrowcoaching.com. I'm also on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. And so we're always posting different things to help you bust your imposter syndrome. And thank you so much for the opportunity to chat with you. It has been my honor to spend time with you. I love your work. And I'm so, so grateful that you had the courage to step out of your imposter syndrome and do the shadow work, because I know your work is having ripple effects in the world that you don't even know about. So
thank you. I appreciate you. I hope that we can keep in touch and our paths cross again very soon. You're delightful. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you for saving the world too.
I mean, oh my gosh, you're hilarious. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. I will definitely be in touch. All right.
Sounds good.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye. You take care.
Bye. You too.